I do often wonder aloud what Jesus would do with a gun. And I think most evangelicals know deep inside that somehow this is in contradiction to the model and teaching of Christ. And so I raise those questions. For me, this is a moral, ethical, and even theological exploration. And I think that's, you know, arguably the founder of evangelicalism, John Wesley of the Methodist Church, said that evangelical Christianity is a religion of the heart. So I think Abby is just, I call her Abby. She's Director Abigail Disney, but I call her Abby, and we have a great friendship. And I think Abby did just the right thing with this film in aiming for the heart rather than the head on this one. I think Lucy's story, spirituality in general, but specifically biblical spirituality, will win the day, with my camp anyway, whereas statistics don't go over very well.
And Lucy Beth, we have Macbeth, we have less than a minute, but what this has meant to you, the making of this film after the loss of your son, and your efforts to try to affect the nation on gun control and gun violence?
I think it's a way of, to be able to scream to the nation, please, as a victim, I know firsthand, you know, the devastation that, you know, these kinds of crimes and gun violence are causing in the country. We have to morally and ethically really address what's happening and not see these cases and incidences as statistics and numbers. And morally, we are accountable to one another.
We're going to have to leave it there. I also want to encourage people to see our Hour with Lucy Macbeth in Sundance, the film that was made about her story, 3.5 minutes, and encourage you to see this film. It's a different Disney film, The Armor of Life, the documentary maker, The Army of Light, the documentary filmmaker Abigail Disney made it. And Reverend Shank, thanks very much for joining us in our studio. That does it for our show. We have a job opening at Democracy Now! It's development director. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. The time is 5:01, and coming up next, we have the KBOO Evening News.
I'm Sonny Blechinger, KBOO's Artist in Residence for 2015. I hope you'll tune in on October 29th at 10 p.m. for my radio play, The Pool. It's about four people that happen to swim at the same public pool every week, and even though they don't know each other, they've mostly decided they don't like each other. And you get to hear their thoughts.
I don't know what I was thinking. Swimmy, this is horrible.
So please tune in for the world premiere, really, of The Pool on October 29th at 10 p.m. It'll be fun, like swimming.
People love swimming in the Crystal Plunge.
God, that creepy lifeguard is still staring at me.
Okay, let's just put the stuff down.
This is my time. My time in the pool.
Tune in Wednesday, October 28th, 6 to 7 p.m. for The Underground, hosted by the KBOO Youth Collective. This month's theme is horror. We will be playing stories about Five Nights at Freddy's, working at a haunted house, and the scariest stories that have happened to people. Again, that's The Underground, Wednesday, October 28th, 6 to 7 p.m., KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News. Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a South Carolina deputy who assaulted a teenage girl has been fired.
The Portland City Council agrees on a new contract with police lieutenants that the Portland City Council agrees on a new contract with police lieutenants that includes the removal of the 48-hour rule.
And Iran has been brought to the table for negotiations regarding ending the war in Syria.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 28th, 2015. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. A teacher at Clackamas High School has filed a lawsuit against the North Clackamas School District, alleging that school officials defamed her to police and coworkers after she requested a leave of absence to deal with the consequences of having been raped. The alleged rape took place in Portland on a Monday in October of 2014, when the teacher reported that, quote, something really bad has happened, unquote, and that she needed time off to take care of it. She says that she was subjected to an interrogation by Clackamas High School assistant principal Wendy Ryder. Thereafter, Ryder and a school resource officer called Portland police in an attempt to verify the rape report, and in so doing, told a police dispatcher that the teacher was disorganized and possibly not truthful. When a Portland police officer came to her home to investigate, he intimated to the teacher that people at the high school had said she was a methamphetamine addict. Thereafter, Clackamas High School principal Christine Garcia sent an email to staff to notify them of the teacher's upcoming absence and to complain about the disruption it was causing. The teacher says she has subsequently been diagnosed with PTSD. Multnomah County District Attorneys have declined to prosecute the rape, saying in a memo that they don't believe they could prove the charges beyond a reasonable doubt.
The Portland City Council this morning voted to approve a revised contract with the union representing the city's police lieutenants. One of the changes in the new contract involves the so-called 48-hour rule. This is a rule that police claim gives them the right to wait 48 hours to file a report after a use of force incident. Under the new lieutenant's contract, the officers will give up the standard 48 hours notice before they're asked to give an initial interview for an internal police investigation. Anna Conwit with the Bureau of Human Resources spoke at the city council meeting about this change.
We also reached an agreement on Article 29, which is the provision in the PPCA contract dealing with interview safeguards, and the language in the contract that was pretty much identical to what's in the PPA contract requiring a 48-hour advance notice has been deleted. And currently what we have is obviously we would inform the member of an initial interview, whether they're a suspect or a witness, and provide an opportunity for them to meet with an attorney if they choose. But there is a provision that can't cause a delay in the investigation. So I think that's a huge move for the city, very, very important. I was very pleased that PPCOA agreed to that as well.
Lieutenants are not often involved in use of force incidents, so their use of the 48-hour rule is quite rare. But as negotiations open on a new contract for the city's rank-and-file officers, this could become a sticking point. A settlement between the U.S. Department of Justice and the Portland Police in 2014 noted that the 48-hour rule is a major problem, and the judge overseeing the agreement has advised that the city end the policy. The judge says the rule is used to allow police officers who have just shot or killed a suspect time to confer with union lawyers before giving a statement of their version of events. No other person charged with a crime is given the chance to have 48 hours to get their story straight before being asked to give a statement.
Two people are dead after an explosion in a Second World War-era tank at a gun range outside of Bend. The victims have not yet been identified. The explosion took place yesterday afternoon at the Central Oregon Shooting Sports Association, a public gun range in the tiny unincorporated community of Milliken, east of Bend. State police and Deschutes County sheriffs are investigating, but they have not yet identified the cause of this explosion.
A South Carolina sheriff's deputy who flipped a student off her chair onto the floor has been fired. The local sheriff's office found that Deputy Ben Fields went too far when he picked up the 16-year-old and hurled her across a classroom before arresting her. Civil rights groups and several elected officials applauded the officer's dismissal, which came 2 days after videos by students at Spring Valley High School in Columbia recorded the incident. The videos quickly went viral, reigniting concerns that the proliferation of police in U.S. schools can criminalize behavior once handled more quietly by school officials. A civil rights probe by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and Justice Department into the arrest is underway, and the State Law Enforcement Division also is investigating. Some activists are calling for the sheriff to be criminally charged. The teacher and administrator who witnessed the encounter felt Fields acted appropriately.
The Coast Guard is investigating a leak from a sunken oil barge in western Lake Erie that's believed to be the Argo, which went down in 1937 while carrying an estimated 100,000 gallons of crude oil. For more, we go to Rebecca Williams with the Environment Report.
There's a shipwreck in Lake Erie that might have thousands of gallons of oil still on board, and it appears to be leaking. This is the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams. The Coast Guard is investigating a leak from a 78-year-old tank barge in western Lake Erie. It's believed to be the Argo. It sank in a storm in 1937. Records show it was carrying about 100,000 gallons of crude oil when it sank. No one knows yet what exactly is still on board. A dive team with the Cleveland Underwater Explorers reported a leak of an unknown substance from the barge on Friday night. The Coast Guard confirmed the leak on Saturday, and that triggered the emergency response. Lieutenant Greg Schweitzer is with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He's helping the Coast Guard with its response effort. A dive team is on Lake Erie today to try to find the leak.
Whether or not they're successful in identifying the leak depends on whether or not the leak is still active. If it's not, it'll probably be very difficult for the divers to determine where that source is.
He says the wreck is covered in zebra mussels. That makes it hard to tell if there are cracks in the hull. The Coast Guard says there's no immediate risk to human health. I got a chance to visit the wreck site last week before anyone discovered it was leaking.
I'm Tom Kowalsik. I'm a member of CLU, Cleveland Underwater Explorers. I do the remote scanning, searching for the shipwrecks.
This is the guy who found the tank barge in late August. For the past 40 years, he's spent his weekends looking for shipwrecks. He dials up the GPS coordinates, and we motor out into Lake Erie. We're about an hour away from shore when...
There it is, right there. Just went over top of the wreck.
The boat's depth finder shows a big peak when we go over the barge. Kowalsik says the Argo was not built for the open waters of Lake Erie.
You know, as you can tell, we're rocking pretty good right now. And you could imagine a tugboat pulling a fully loaded barge that only had 2 foot of freeboard. It was only sticking out of the water 2 feet. And these huge big waves crashing down on it. And it didn't survive the storm.
Kowalsik says he just happened on this wreck. He was pulling a device that uses sound waves to map the bottom of the lake, and there it was.
All of the historic record for the sinking said that it was considerable distance, many miles, 5 or 6 miles north of where we are right now. When it showed up on the screen, I was really surprised because I wasn't expecting really to see anything here.
It turns out the Argo was already on a list of hazardous shipwrecks, but no one knew exactly where it was. In 2013, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration published a risk assessment of shipwrecks that could be pollution hazards. The Argo is considered the biggest pollution threat from a shipwreck in the Great Lakes. Lisa Simons is with NOAA's Office of National Marine Sanctuaries. She wrote the risk assessment. She says the barge's records indicate it was carrying close to 200,000 gallons of two petroleum products, a product called benzol and crude oil.
Our assumption is that it was a half and half cargo, but we have no way of knowing for sure.
She says they only modeled the pollution threat for the crude oil.
We didn't model it for the benzol because we believe the benzol probably volatilized at the time of the incident. It's a much lighter fuel, and that would have been more likely to be able to get out of the wreck more easily.
Simon says the barge had been loaded with its cargo not long before it sank. The big question now is, how much of that oil is still on the barge? First, the Coast Guard has to investigate the leak. Then it'll look into how to deal with what's still on board. That's the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams.
Oregon may join several other states and the federal government in the ongoing attempt to curb the poaching of animals for ivory. U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer, a Democrat who represents Oregon's 3rd District, is one of the chief petitioners behind a ballot measure that would ban the sale of ivory in Oregon. Petitioners must collect almost 90,000 signatures from registered voters by next summer and then hope that the measure passes in the 2016 election. Washington voters will tackle a similar measure in November. California Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill banning ivory sales earlier this month. A bill banning ivory sales stalled in the Oregon legislature this year. Officials in the African nation of Zimbabwe say that at least 62 elephants have been killed by cyanide poisoning this year. Critics of the bill say that banning sales of ivory will not significantly affect the market for poached ivory and will impact the value of older works of art done in ivory. An unmanned U.S. Army blimp broke free of its mooring yesterday under mysterious circumstances. The blimp is one of a pair that makes up the missile-detecting JLENS system. After breaking free, the blimp then proceeded to drift across the state of Pennsylvania, leaving power outages in its wake as its mile-long tether dragged behind it. It then landed just as mysteriously today. No one is certain just how the blimp and its inch-thick tether came loose, and no one is sure how it came down, seemingly on its own, despite being constructed to withstand gunfire.
Evening news. This will be followed by, at 5:45, by a special report featuring the voices of Portlanders sharing their stories of racial and ethnic profiling at last night's hearing on profiling by Oregon's Attorney General. At 6 o'clock, it's The Underground, KBOO's program by youth under age 21. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will show us a few showers early with a high around 62, moving to steady rain and 53 tomorrow night. Today in history, on October 28, 1886, President Grover Cleveland dedicated the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor to commemorate the centennial of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Our quote of the day is from Terry Pratchett, a British author of fantasy novels, who said, "It's useful to go out of this world to see it from the perspective of another one."
A comprehensive, statistically robust study out of Vanderbilt University is calling into question the value of one of the favorite causes of education reformers everywhere, universal pre-kindergarten education. The study finds that children who go to pre-kindergarten programs arrive in school better prepared, but that those advantages seem to disappear relatively quickly, perhaps within the first year of schooling. This isn't the first study to find these results. A study of Quebec, Canada's universal pre-K program found limited to no benefits for its students. For years, education reformers have advocated for universal pre-kindergarten on the basis of a study that tracked students over decades and found that those who attended pre-K programs lived healthier, wealthier lives. The Vanderbilt study did not follow students for nearly so long, and some researchers say it should be taken with a grain of salt for that reason. Others say the conditions of the previous study did not reflect the conditions of 21st century schools. One issue the study did not consider was the effect of pre-K programs on parents. Pre-K functions as a regular childcare for working parents, especially for working mothers who are far more likely to remain employed if their children are in school daily.
Former U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert pled guilty this morning to charges that he evaded banking laws. Hastert is a Republican who represented wealthy suburbs west of Chicago during the Reagan, Clinton, and both Bush administrations. He told the court that he had been withdrawing money from his accounts in chunks of $10,000 each, in an attempt to avoid questions from the authorities about what he was spending that money on. Over the course of 4 years, Hastert withdrew as much as $1.7 million. The Associated Press and other outlets have reported that the money was paid to an unidentified individual who was blackmailing Hastert over sexual misconduct he committed as a teacher in an Illinois high school in the 1970s. By pleading guilty, Hastert averts a potentially embarrassing trial. The government has also agreed to drop charges related to lying to the FBI. Sentencing guidelines indicate that Hastert should serve about 6 months in prison, but the judge on the case says he may sentence Hastert to as much as 5 years. Hastert is the longest-serving Republican Speaker of the House in U.S. history, having held the job from 1999 until 2007. Since leaving the House, he has been pursuing a lucrative lobbying career. Experts say that a felony conviction will almost certainly end that career.
Representative Paul Ryan from Wisconsin has been nominated as the Speaker of the House and is expected to be confirmed tomorrow. For more, KBOO's Jenkins Soderberg spoke with Robert Craig of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Check, check. We are joined on the line now by Robert Craig, the Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Now, Robert, we have heard that Paul Ryan, your representative, has been nominated as the Speaker of the House. Let's talk about some of the issues with Paul Ryan. Does he actually want to cut Medicare and cut the budget so only the military budget is left?
Great to be with you, and the answer is yes. This is someone whose record is extremely well documented because he has written the budget for the House Republicans for several years in a row, and these budgets have projected out for decades. And so in these budgets, he privatizes Medicare and makes it a voucher system, putting insurance companies in the middle, which would probably double cost for seniors, but also would increase cost to federal government, so not reduce the deficit at all. And then if you project out, as Dean Baker, the well-known economist, has pointed out, his budgets over decades, they actually would have only military spending in them. So they literally project zeroing out all non-defense spending. So it is correct to say that there'd be nothing but military spending if Ryan's budgets actually became law and we stuck to them for decades.
Wow. And how did Paul Ryan reach such prominence with positions like these?
It's a very good question. This is a guy who's risen rapidly. He was elected to Congress very young in an upset, in his mid-20s. And he's created this reputation as kind of among Washington insiders, being a policy wonk, as someone who has serious proposals to make. The problem is, if you actually look at his budgets, they're not serious. The math doesn't add up. They don't balance the budget any time. They're simply kind of Trojan horses for a right-wing agenda of lowering taxes on large corporations and the wealthy, cutting most of the investments to expand economic opportunity, and building up military spending further. But for some reason, he's treated as more serious. He's been very good at branding himself as a serious conservative thinker and someone who has new ideas, but really when you dig into the ideas, they're Trojan horses for a standard right-wing agenda. He's actually a disciple of Ayn Rand, and that actually explains a lot. And he's been very clear about that. He's admitted that he's been greatly influenced by Ayn Rand and her view, basically, that people who are successful in our society are the heroes, and everyone else who needs opportunity is simply a parasite of some kind who is trying to take advantage or be dependent upon government.
Oh, what kind of possibility is there now that Paul Ryan is going to be Speaker of the House that his agenda will move forward in the House and we will see cuts to Medicare and other essential services that the government provides?
It's a very good question, and it depends how he plays it. He's gone into a very difficult situation. The Boehner speakership was really bedeviled by the fact that they have a Tea Party fringe in the House that actually believes conservative ideology. They were the Tea Party rebellion was fomented deliberately by large interests, but they elected a group of people that actually want to shut the government down, and Boehner could not bridge the gap between those people and the more establishment Republicans ultimately want to do the bidding of large special interests that want to get things out of government. Ryan is seen as trying to bridge that gap. So he's going to try to give enough red meat for the Freedom Caucus to keep them happy, but then he wants to keep the doors of government open so they can continue with gigantic subsidies to show oil, for example, to pharma, to other major interests, and that fund the Republican Party. And so I think you're going to see kind of a combination of pragmatism in terms of making sure that the right doesn't harm itself and damage its political prospects by shutting down the government, but then also an attempt to feed red meat to the far right and keep it happy and keep the party unified. I don't know if he can put that Rubik's Cube back together, but he will try to do so. I think what will definitely not happen is he will not do any of the things he has suggested around poverty, for example, despite trying to carve out that area, because he can't do that and unify his caucus. The big choice we're going to see is we have a decision very soon about whether we extend very large tax cuts to the wealthy and large corporations. We're talking, they're called the tax extenders. They're $500 billion worth of these. But there's also a decision whether to extend tax breaks for working people, enhancements of the income tax credit and the child tax credit that keep tens of thousands of children out of poverty. And if Paul Ryan decides to try to not extend the tax help for working families just above the poverty line, trying to make it in our society, but wants to extend half of, you know, $500 billion to the wealthy and large corporations, that will tell a lot. And we'll know that in early December.
Well, and we will, of course, continue to follow this issue. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Craig. He's the executive director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. He has in the past written about Paul Ryan in pieces like, Is There a Wisconsin Conservative with the Guts to Defend Ryan's Budget in Public? This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Iran has agreed to a meeting to be held in Vienna on this coming Friday to work toward ending the war in Syria. The meeting is the first of its kind and will include representatives from Iran's hostile neighbor, Saudi Arabia. The two countries have agreed to meet, along with Egypt, Iraq, Qatar, Lebanon, the European Union, and France, to discuss and determine the readiness to bring the bloody conflict in Syria to end after more than 4 years. The talks also represent the first time that Iran has been represented in diplomatic talks to resolve the Syrian conflict, even though many Iranian soldiers, including top commanders, have died in the fighting. The United States, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey are scheduled to meet Thursday in a smaller set of talks.
Intercept has released a report outlining the use of a non-governmental organization to conduct spying efforts on North Korea. KBOO's Jimmy Tardy spoke with Professor Kim Sipes, professor of sociology at Purdue University, about this issue.
I'm Jimmy Tardy. I'm joined on the phone by Kim Sipes. He's an associate professor of sociology at Purdue University, also the author of The AFL-CIO's Secret War Against Developing Country Workers, Solidarity or Sabotage. Thanks for joining me, Professor Sipes. And we are talking today about the piece that came out in Intercept about the United States military using a Christian NGO as a front for North Korea espionage. The NGO in question is the Humanitarian International Services Group, or HISG. It's an NGO, a non-governmental organization. HISG was known for collecting and delivering clothing items into North Korea, and also it came out that they were also smuggling Bibles in along with the clothing shipments, and apparently that was an effort by the Pentagon to test their ability to smuggle in other types of equipment into North Korea. Sam Worthington, the president of Interaction, an association of nearly 200 American NGOs, notes that using humanitarian workers as spies violates international principles and puts legitimate aid and development workers at risk. Tell us what you know about this story, Professor Sipes.
Using non-governmental organizations, now they're just what they say. They're not in the government. They do humanitarian aid. They bring in food. They bring in clothing. They provide hospital care, just like or medical care, just like Doctors Without Borders that we just blew up in Afghanistan. This kind of work. And the United States is using their access to, in this case, North Korea, to try to get some intelligence information. There's two things wrong with this. I mean, first, the obvious thing is we're spending billions and billions of dollars on the intelligence budget. And if that spy versus spy stuff that they have doesn't work, then we need to quit spending that money. That's just stupid. But the bigger problem is that it endangers anyone who goes overseas to do any type of humanitarian work, and especially if they're Americans. Because no matter how good the work is, they are not deemed trustworthy. They're suspicious. They're probably going to get followed. And if anything happens, these people are in a world of hurt. And the U.S. government will probably not come help them anyway on top of it. So it's just a lose-lose all the way around. Incredibly stupid.
And our listeners may be aware that, like you're mentioning, the issue of trustworthiness among international NGOs, trust is the primary unit of currency that they use to conduct their efforts. They, of course, rely on monetary donations, and they rely on the volunteer efforts of scores of people. But without that trust, all of their ability to move around freely and preferentially unescorted by armed troops not only puts their ability to accomplish their primary function at risk by limiting their access to areas, but it also puts the individual volunteers who are on the ground at risk.
Absolutely. And I want to point out that, you know, your people who are doing development aid and stuff, they're not all volunteers. Some get stipends, but most people are not making very much money, and it's a very great risk of their own, and they're trying to do it, trying to make the world a better place. So they're using their good heart and their willingness to go in and work and stuff to help out people who are not getting help, who need help desperately, who are not getting it from the various governments. And the one thing that keeps them safe is their honesty and their trustworthiness. You're absolutely right. And to risk that for any reason is stupid. The CIA used to use journalists the same way, and when that got exposed, that got ended. The U.S. government shouldn't be doing this, and they're doing it not only, I mean, you know, the case in Korea is one case that we've seen, but we also have to keep in mind that the U.S. is working through NGOs. We've got an agency called it's got a terrible name, it's the National Endowment for Democracy. That sounds really good. Well, it has nothing to do with the democracy that you and I might think of, but is coming in and basically they're supporting groups that are anti-government and stuff like this in a number of countries. And by the U.S. trying to subvert these NGO operations, it's just harming people around the world as well as putting their people at risk. It's just insane.
As I mentioned at the beginning of this interview, you're the officer of the AFL-CIO's Secret War Against Developing Country Workers Solidarity or Sabotage.
Right.
What's the parallels drawn between this case and what the AFL-CIO is doing as you claim in your book?
The AFL-CIO's top-level leadership, and this I want to be real clear because it's top-level leadership. It's done without the knowledge of most leaders in the labor movement, much less rank-and-file members. The AFL-CIO has had its own independent foreign policy for over 100 years. And what they've done is they've gone around different countries. They have their documented cases that I have in my book where they participated in helping to overthrow democratically elected governments, such as Guatemala in 54, Brazil in 64, Chile in 63, and they were indirectly involved in the coup in Venezuela in 2002. So they have helped try to overthrow democratically elected governments. They have supported dictators and labor movements that support dictators all around the world. In some cases, they're doing some work that's not bad, but there's never been an honest report or anything like this. So the AFL-CIO is doing similar things. In fact, it works with the National Endowment for Democracy that I was just talking about to operate around the world using the trust of the labor movement. And it has nothing to do with the labor movement. It's not supported by most of the people in the labor movement. Most people don't even know this is happening. So my book's an effort to delineate what's been going on and call for union members to demand that this stuff be stopped because it's coming out of, the top levels of the labor movement. I think we have to understand the foreign policy of the United States has been to dominate the world. This has especially been true in the post-World War II period, and some argue it goes back to 1898. In other words, I'm arguing that we have a U.S. empire. And I think our rulers in D.C., are operating around the world trying to maintain that empire. The empire is being challenged around the world. I think it's losing power, and they're desperately trying to maintain hold, absolutely. And they'll do anything they can. I think it's very dangerous, and you see this going around the world. I think part of the thing that we've got to do as far as civil society is we've got to understand, one, where not just a country, we're actually the heartland of an empire, and demand that our elected leaders in particular cut back military spending. We could cut it back 90% without any harm to our defense, because we can either try to dominate the world or we can take care of American people, because that money cannot go to health care or education or infrastructure or dealing with climate change if we're trying to dominate the world. So American people have to choose. What are we going to do? Are we going to try to dominate the world? Are we going to take care of the American people? I think that's the crucial
question that's got to be addressed by the American people.
I've been speaking with Associate Professor of Sociology at Purdue University, Professor Kim Sipes, about the recent Intercept report titled U.S. Military Used Christian NGO as Front for North Korea Espionage, and also the parallels with his book, The AFL-CIO's Secret War Against Developing Country Workers, Solidarity or Sabotage. Thanks for your time, Professor Sipes.
You're welcome. Anytime. Thank you.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, October 28, 2015. Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian youth in Hebron and injure 19 others in ongoing clashes. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. One Palestinian youth was killed by Israeli army gunfire on Wednesday afternoon, while at least 19 others were injured as clashes continued all over the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem and Gaza. Islam Rafiq Ubaid, 23, was shot by Israeli troops near illegal Israeli settlement located in Tel Rameda area of Hebron Old City, south of the West Bank. Witnesses said that Ubaid was shot 11 times by Israeli troops manning a checkpoint there. Soldiers also detained Palestinian medics and stopped them from providing Ubaid with medical help. According to witnesses, he was left to bleed to death by Israeli forces that surrounded the area and closed it. Ubaid is the seventh Palestinian to be killed by Israeli troops in Hebron in the past 72 hours, the Palestinian Ministry of Health reported on Wednesday. The health ministry said that 65 Palestinians, including 14 children, have been killed by Israeli army gunfire since the beginning of this month so far. 48 of them have been killed in the occupied West Bank and occupied Jerusalem, 17 in the Gaza Strip, including a pregnant woman and her 2-year-old child. Moreover, clashes between local youth and invading Israeli troops on Wednesday were reported in Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron, Nablus, and Ramallah. Palestinian sources said that 19 Palestinians were injured by Israeli army gunfire and tear gas during clashes on Wednesday. Among the injured, 2 children were hit with live gunfire in Hebron Old City clashes. Meanwhile, a teenager was hit in the head by a rubber-coated steel bullet during clashes with Israeli soldiers at the entrance of Beit Fajar village near Bethlehem. On Wednesday at dawn, Israeli forces invaded Palestinian communities in occupied West Bank and Jerusalem, searched and ransacked residents' homes and kidnapped 72 Palestinians, including university students and children. The Palestinian Political Prisoner Society said in a press statement that the kidnappings and home searches took place in Jerusalem, Hebron, Bethlehem, Ramallah and Jenin. In Hebron district alone, troops kidnapped 31 residents, the Political Prisoner Society reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, October 28, 2015, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
The Iraqi government prime minister announced Wednesday that the Iraqi government did not ask for and does not need any direct action on the ground by U.S. forces. This announcement came one day after Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter announced that the U.S. Army may carry out more unilateral ground raids with the recapture of the Iraqi city of Ramadi as key objective, as well as plans to train local forces already in the conflict. According to the Iraqi prime minister, military involvement by the U.S. in Iraq must be cleared through their government.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joseph Jordan, Robin Ryan, and Jimmy Tardy. Our producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineers are Ian Westmoreland and June Siegel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jekka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty discusses Portland Mayor Charlie Hale's announcement that he will not run for a second term in the upcoming election season. At 9, Press Watch is off. Instead, Per Fagering hosts Fight the Empire with guest Roger Lowenstein, talking about his new book, America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. At 10, Air Cascadia is also off, so we'll go to Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on Between the Covers, right on time for Halloween, we hear a conversation with Amelia Gray, whose book, Gutshot, pushes against the outer limits of what humans can and will do. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. If you're not a member, just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum held a hearing last night in Portland to hear from the public about police profiling. HB 2002, the End Profiling Act, established the Law Enforcement Profiling Work Group chaired by Oregon's Attorney General. The work group is tasked with working to identify and stop patterns and practices of profiling. It will then make recommendations to the legislature. Here's some of the testimony from last night's hearing.
My name is Omar, and I'm with CIO. Oregon is changing all around us, and we must get ready to welcome people from different backgrounds. My story is a little bit, a small part of what people of color go through in Oregon. I had a blessed opportunity to work with police officers with the PAL Activities League. My job is I work with the Parks Bureau. My job is to equity and inclusion in all platforms with the Parks Bureau. So my story was when a couple years ago, on around April 20th of the stereotypic of 420, me and my friend were driving from King City, heading towards Barber to Portland, and we get pulled over by King City and Tigard Police. When that happened, we were very, you know, calm as general, but from the jump, the police officers were very nervous and were very suspicious. My hands were on my lap because from history, I knew that keep my hands where they can see my hands so nothing happens. They automatically prejudged us and said, get out of the vehicle. We listened because we obeyed their commands because we didn't want to cause any conflict. Afterwards, automatically when we got out of the car, the police officers on my end asked me, what are you doing in my city? I responded, I'm a taxpayer, this is my city, and I'm here coming from a friend's house, heading home. From that incident, That really changed my view with the city, with just general the city bureaus and the Portland Police Bureau, and as well as Tiger, just in general, because I felt that they didn't include me as a citizen.
Hi, my name is Jerzy Deutsch. I'm volunteering with CIO today, the Center for Intercultural Organizing. I'm also an organizer with TransUnity. I'm just going to kind of go over a story that happened 3 years ago, or 2.5 years ago, like right when I moved to Portland from Southern California. I was really excited to get here. Everyone was talking about Portland's transgender community and how accepting Portland is, and it's really exciting. It was literally about a week and a half after I got here. I was pulled over for driving 5 miles under the speed limit. A cop took a look at me and was really aggressive when asking for my ID, and was getting really loud and intense, and asked me if I had a record, and was asking me what was on my record, and just kind of kept asking me, and when I told him I didn't, he didn't believe me. I gave him my name because I couldn't find my ID, and I kind of kept scrounging through the car, and so was my partner, but it was getting just really nervous and heavy. And while he started writing my name down, because I didn't think he was going to do that, I said, oh, actually, my legal name is, and it was a female's name. And he said, he was like, your legal name? And he said, I'll be right back. And when he said, I'll be right back, he sounded relatively calm in how he had been acting. And when he came back, he reached his hand through my window and unlocked the car from the inside and opened the door and told me I was arrested for lying to an officer. And I was in total shock, and he dragged me by my shirt, even though I was like willing to go with him. And he was pulling me so hard, my feet were dragging on the ground. And him and his partner, who was at the car, put me in the car, they gave my partner a breathalyzer to make sure she was able to drive, which seemed kind of strange. And after, when he brought me into jail, he first put